Elizabeth Acevedo has been in Vermilion this week as part of National Poetry Month and for conversations on race and civility. Acevedo is a National Slam Champion, Beltway Grand Slam Champion, and the 2016 Women of the World Poetry Slam representative for Washington, D.C., where she lives and works. She stopped by the studios yesterday to talk about folktales and poetry, radical empathy, and thinking deeply about, as she puts it, what master your language serves.
I hope that it's inspirational. I never know. But I knew from a very young age that I wanted to tell stories. You know, I remember being maybe 4 or 5 and not yet being able to write. And my neighbor would have me talk to her plants because she said it would help them grow. And I would make up all of these little songs that I would like sing to the plants and get so frustrated I couldn't remember them. Right? And so I'm like, one day I'm going to know how to write and I'm going to put these down and then like I'll be able to say them out loud. And I think that was where it started, this like urge to make language permanent so that I could return to it. Yeah. And so even from when I was little, I wanted to tell stories, and I come from a long line of storytellers, not the most educated folks, right? My grandfather only had a third grade education, but could tell these long riddles. You know, and my mother tells these amazing stories about where she's from, and my dad has all of these jokes. So I come from folks who tell stories and have a long tradition of memorization. So since I was little.
What's the experience of sort of receiving that story as a kid? What's the context and how those stories were told? Around the dinner table, in a circle, like now we're going to tell a story? Mm-hmm. How was that space created?
It was very informal. Mm-hmm. I will say I didn't watch a lot of Disney movies growing up. Right, we had The Little Mermaid and we had Lion King, and that was all I saw growing up. Those were the two we had on repeat. And I didn't grow up with fairy tales. I grew up with my mother telling me about where she was from. And like, you know, I loved the story about her dropping like the package she went to pick off her mare. And I loved the one about like her and her sister. She's one of 15. And so I loved listening to all of these stories, and that was what I grew up on, though. That was my Disney. And so it was very informal, just based on where we were. Someone might launch into like a 30-minute story, and that was normal.
And where is your mother from?
Both my parents are from the Dominican Republic.
All right. So is there a mythology or a folktale from the Dominican Republic that was passed down, or were they all personal stories of what happened?
So a little bit of both. I think it's hard sometimes to tell like what's personal. Everyone has a personal attachment to myths, right?
Right.
But I didn't grow up thinking of them as mythology or of folktales. I grew up thinking of them as like my mother's stories. And it wasn't until I got much older and started really asking, like, what are the stories of this island? What are the stories of where we're from? And really started investigating that. And my last book is a collection thinking about all those stories that are being lost in some ways because no one tells them anymore. Everybody's moving to the city, and the city is a little bit less in tune or attached to folklore.
Yeah. So what happens when those stories are sort of lost? And not only the story itself, but the experience of the exchange.
I mean, I think there's been such a push all over the world, really, for adoption of certain what we consider elevated cultures. I think about the classics, right? That I knew so much about Greek mythology and Roman mythology, and so many of us do, because it's in movies, it's in epigraphs, it's in everything. And then we lose our own stories. And like, what is it that makes us unique, and what is it that we believed in for centuries, and all of a sudden we're believing this other thing? And I think that's what happens when these oral traditions get lost because people are moving, or because, you know, it's not real, that's fake, all of these ideas that come through. And, you know, I'm really curious as to how stories are being passed down. And I think Dominicans tend to be very oral folks and tend to teach a lot of lessons using stories as points. And so that's still happening. But I don't know if it's necessarily the mythology and folklore that it used to be. It's more like personal examples.
Yeah. Did you take that with you into school, into college, and beyond in a way that said, this is part of my identity, this is part of who I am? Are there times when those stories, you know, made a difference into how you interacted with others?
For sure. I mean, I think there are just what I consider cultural norms based off of these stories. Just like my mother didn't believe you should wash underwear in a washing machine. She thinks washing machines do not get it as clean.
Okay.
She grew up hand washing, and you hand wash. I remember going to undergrad, and I would hand wash my underwear and then put them on the shower rod, and my roommates were freaking out. They're like, what is this? And I thought that was totally normal because I'd been told my whole life, like, machines do not get things as clean as your hands do. Yeah. Your hands get things clean, right? And so this idea of what my hands could and could not do was something that I had never even considered might not be how other folks do it, right? And so that's a really simple example. But certainly, you know, the mythology of growing up with, like, a boogeyman, and we have our own kind of boogeyman, and, like, what happens in the dark? Or, you know, I grew up believing certain things about dreams and what dreams mean. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and then folks are like, no, it's all psychology, and Freud says none of that is real, and it's all about, like, you know, sexual desire. And I'm pretty sure my mother told me that's not what this is, right? And so it's having to contextualize it all.
Who's your boogeyman?
El cuco.
Mm-hmm. Tell me.
And el cuco is just this figure that is dressed in, like, all black, and, like, he will come out if you're not a good kid. Uh-huh. You know? And so it's the exact same story of the boogeyman, but just that is a very specific name, and he has a very specific kind of kid he comes for. And we have these stories of, you know, La Ciguapa is what opens up my book, this woman who with backward-facing feet, mm-hmm. who would walk through the mountains, and people couldn't follow her because they couldn't tell what direction her feet were going in, but that she would lead people, you know, out of enslavement, mm-hmm. and she would lead men into, like, insanity. And right. So, like, if you came for her, she was, like, this almost feminist figure.
Yeah.
Right? You couldn't come for her without her being able to escape you, and so that idea was a really cool one growing up of, you know, how do you get out of certain situations, and this right. mythological figure that did it.
And that moment where you're in college and your roommates say, what are you doing with your underwear? That can be a moment of, oh, I'm different. That could be a moment of, oh, you're different and your underwear is clearly dirty. Or it can be a moment of awareness and exchange from two different sort of backgrounds, storytelling backgrounds. What was that moment like for you?
Every moment was, there were so many of those moments, and it depended on what it was, right? That depending on how it was presented, there was shame, right? For someone, like, to say, like, you know, hand washing is so, there was almost this idea of, like, oh, it's primitive, or it's like, we have machines now, why would you do that, right? And I was considering that, and I think I just struggled with, well, what does that mean? And now these are strangers. Maybe they shouldn't be looking at my underwear. And so that was what I was grappling with.
Right.
I remember, you know, one of my roommates teaching me how she made spaghetti, and she, like, grabbed the spaghetti and throws it on the wall. She's like, well, now it's stuck. That's how you know it's done. And I'm like, did you just throw food at your wall? Like, that? Who throws food? Right. So that was the moment where I'm like, oh, that does not make any sense. My mom would not throw food anywhere, right? And so I think it just depends. Every moment was a different kind of exchange. And it was a storytelling. It was, oh, this is how you do things.
Right.
Right? And in your head, you're like, you're judging on, like, will I do this? Won't I do this? Will I do, you know, like, what do you adopt? What do you leave behind? Yeah. And so every moment was different.
Storytelling as a way to address issues of social injustice. You mentioned that. So let's elaborate on it. How does that fit in to, you know, a cultural action?
Right. I mean, I think a lot about how the stories we tell about people and repeat about people become truth. And really, I'm thinking about, like, how do we stereotype and how do we disrupt stereotypes? One of the examples I've been thinking a lot recently is, you know, there's been an opiate addiction problem in this country for many years. Right? I grew up in New York City where, like, I grew up seeing folks addicted to crack cocaine and knew what that was from a very young age. And knew that folks would get arrested for doing crack, and knew that they were left in the streets, and knew that they were not going to get help, right? And we had all these kind of derogatory terms to call them, and you did not want to be that. And now there's this new kind of push for, oh, well, heroin addicts, right? And that's not a drug abuse problem. Now it's the heroin epidemic.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Now it's like we have to help, and it's because that demographic is very different than the demographic who was on crack. And what is the story that we tell about these different groups based off of where they're from and what they look like, although the addiction is very similar.
Right.
And so I think about that there's a violence to our language when we use it, you know, as a euphemism to help some and as a way to criminalize others. And so that was really what I was thinking about. What is the story we tell of people in neighborhoods? Because that's also an urban versus suburban story and narrative. And just trying to process that. And encouraging folks, what I was saying this morning is, you know, what master does your language serve? Mm-hmm. That our language always is serving an idea or a cultural norm. And are you questioning who that master is and where you got this belief from? Mm-hmm. And that you should be, I think, right? And that if that master is not based in, like, radical empathy, there's a way in which you might be doing it wrong.
Right. Radical empathy. When you say that, what do you mean?
I mean just this ability to say, if we can only believe one narrative based off of what we may have heard at some point and can't step into what is this other person or this other group going through or believing in, or what is it that is driving them to live in the way that they do, although it may be different from how I live, right? Really stepping outside of yourself, I don't think you can cross cultural divides. I think this idea of social injustice will continue because we're always going to label those others, and they're crackheads, and they're junkies, and they're this and that and the third, and like, we're just sick. Because the way that you use language doesn't allow you to empathize with them as who they are as people. Mm. And I really, you know, think about empathy all the time, and how do we teach, you know, and particularly when I work with young people, how do we teach them to be more human,
right?
And be a part of that experience without just categorizing left and right.
Let's talk about language itself and how we sort of read and write. You know, we're talking about how we think and how we interact with each other, but when you interact with words on a page, you interact with your own pen and a piece of paper. Let's talk about that language and how to more deeply explore what those words mean. That's a strictly poetry thing, kind of.
Right. I think writing is a way of seeing. Mm. And sometimes I look at something and the words that come to mind as I'm trying to process it hit against each other. And there's something amazing that happens when I didn't think those two words would work in this moment, or I have to get that down because I don't know if I'm going to have this description again later. And I love that poetry is a story you can carry in your body, mm-hmm. that you can memorize a poem, and it's this whole complete thing that now you have and that no one can take away, and you don't need a microphone and you don't need an audience, but you have this thing you can repeat if you need to and return to if you need to. It's like this little house in your body. Right. And that language creating that seems amazing to me, right? That we can build a whole world. And that's what I try to do. You know, they say the best poets, you know, have a strong economy of language. Mm-hmm. You know, how to, like, make every word count in a way that I think other forms don't have quite that pithiness. And mm-hmm. so I like thinking about, like, these are my tools, and they're, like, a short set, but they're huge also.
So don't throw the spaghetti at the wall, and don't throw away the words up carelessly either.
Right.
A lot of thought goes into every poem. How do you revise? How do you edit something? Is that something you do out loud? Is that something you do on paper?
You know, I think it's funny because when you go to certain workshops, you're taught, like, you edit visually. How does the poem look on the page? How do you create an aesthetic norm on the page? And I grew up in a culture of listening. So I edit with my ear as well as with my sight, right? The poem wants to be beautiful on the page, but I really trust out loud. And because I perform so often, I think a poem will be done. And I'll read it to myself. And then I'll go out and perform it. And that's a workshop in and of itself because I realize what lines landed, what moment works well, what moment in my head isn't coming across in the language, and then have to go back and reconsider that. I think we edit and revise in multiple ways, and I like using all the tools at my disposal, so both visual and auditory.
Yeah. Will you read something for us?
Yeah.
Tell us about this book.
So my chapbook is called Beast Girl and Other Origin Myths. It was a finalist for Yes Yes Chapbook Contest. Yes Yes is an amazing publisher outside of the West Coast. And it's a little bit thinking about all those myths Mm-hmm. One of the different stories that we believe in. And I'm going to read a poem called Dominican Superstitions. So many of the superstitions I grew up with and that a lot of my friends grew up with. Dominican Superstitions. For falling asleep, don't fall asleep with your knees up, or you'll invite a ghost to mount you. For ghosts, never ask them what they want. That's some American-ish. For ghosts that won't leave, use frankincense. Conduct a rosary circle. Lead them to a tree that guards gold. For nightmares, upon waking, speak your dreams into the air. The witnessing daylight will prevent them from coming true. For nightmares in which teeth crumble like aged cassava, someone you love has died. The teeth always know. For menstrual periods, don't touch any child not your own and don't wash your hair until you've bled for 5 days. For the evil eye, cross yourself and stay away from folks who would give a compliment but do not follow it with a blessing. For reading, don't do it while eating. For eating, don't do it while reading. For kitchens, open an oven or open a refrigerator, but heat and cold air should never tangle in the same body. For men, feed them well and feed them often. The fatter the man, the more likely he's too heavy to leave. For cheating, watch out if you skip a hoop while fastening your belt, because one too many times means someone else has been minding your man. For superstitions, treat them like salt. Scatter them before you leave and let them impale themselves into the soles of your feet.
That's slam poet Elizabeth Acevedo reading from Beast Girl and Other Origin Myths. That was only a portion of our conversation. She read more from her book and performed another poem. If you love poetry and language and you'd like to hear the full conversation with Elizabeth Acevedo, download our weekly podcast version of In the Moment. I'm going to post that later on today. You can find it wherever you source your podcasts or listen to it online at listen.sdpb.org.